Thank you all for hanging in there late in the afternoon. So this is work I've done in another life, and I worked with Ryan Macnack, who now works with me at Google as well, but that's just a coincidence, I'd say, but unrelated. And largely various people from the history of the Newspeak project at hand. So, for starters, what does atomic install in Newspeak mean? It's not clear that you necessarily know what I mean by atomic install, and it's not clear that it's just talking of quickly DL form, whatever you know anything about Newspeak is. So, Newspeak is a programming language. In the Smalltalk tradition, PRO, everything is an object, even in integers and things like that. It's class-based, dynamically typed. And like Smalltalk, there's a very strong emphasis on a live development environment with instantaneous feedback. So you make a change, and the whole world has changed accordingly, right? There is no compile, edit, cycle, that sort of thing. And unlike Smalltalk, there's an emphasis that you speak on things like modularity and other practicalities. That culture of reflectivity that Smalltalk has means that you routinely develop in a manner that is very much like updating programs, right? And whenever you make a change, it immediately affects the running program. You add methods, you remove methods, etc. You can add fields to a class, and all the instances of the class are in the heap automatically reshaped accordingly when you make that change. You change the hierarchy, all sorts of things like that. So, atomic install. Well, in a traditional Smalltalk, as we said, all these changes apply instantly, but you do them sequentially, right? You're editing a method in Smalltalk ID, you add one method, you change another method, do several things one at a time. And that means that you can have inconsistent intermediate states. Right? The logic of your program may depend on a whole series of changes taking place. Now, that's all good and well as long as the program is lying there dead while you do surgery on it. But if you actually have a program that is actually running while you're doing this, which happens to me a lot, because I like to work on the IDEs for these things, and these are live IDEs where you make the changes in the tool, and that's nice because you get instant feedback to this thing. But in that case, if you make a wrong step, you can shoot yourself in the foot. This also implies other things. If you're doing this and you need to worry about luck, it's a change. Did the wrong thing, and there's an error, then error handling, recovering from this, undoing changes, all that is more complicated. In other scenarios where you're concerned about performance, it's more performant to do a series of changes. Someone mentioned in the talk they had encountered a problem with, say, the JVM, when you modify methods, right? You get this effect that if you modify 20 methods, that's 20 times more expensive. Well, if it's geared to an individual method, yeah, you're going to have to de-opt the whole place where this method was in line, etc., and you go through the whole system and do that, and then the next method, if you batch that, you can handle it more efficiently. You traverse the heap for reshaping your objects more efficiently, things like that. So there are all kinds of reasons where essentially what you want to do is to treat all this as a transaction. Right? And basically, it's interesting that the Stone Age actually gave you transactions in this way, because if you sit with a dead text editor that has no relation to your running program and make these modifications, when you've made all of them, loading the program and running it is your transaction. Of course, your program isn't live, and so that's not very interesting. So the idea of atomic install is consistent modification for just an efficient modification of running programs. So I talked about the example of modifying the IDE within itself, in particular when you start doing things like integrating source control in the IDE and pull a whole set of changes and affect them, then you really need them to take place atomically. Much more broadly, though, is this notion of using this for updating services. This idea of objects of software services that I have on and off talked about since, oh, I don't know, 2005 or so. Basically, this is an idea like an app store on steroids, right? It's that you have your data and your applications program as data. Your service keeps it on server. It does the usual things. It gives you backup, it gives you audit, distribution, maintenance, et cetera, collaboration. And whatever you sync up, say your calendar or your document, whatever, then you're going to get the new program and your new data, and it's all going to update and update. So it's a lot of like web applications in a way, that there really is no versioning, but this also works offline, right? This program is a regular line program that can disconnect, and when you reconnect, you have to sort of, like distributed source control, you have to reconcile everything and then update all the objects to get to the new state. So both the program objects, which are verified, and the data. And the important thing is, of course, nothing should ever restart, right? We don't like to go back to the beginning. So as opposed to, you know, the model, which I think in iOS 7, they're actually going to fix this to some extent, right? You don't want to have these annoying notices telling you you have all these things that you have to update. The idea here is that these updates just happen. This should be not harassing the user. Anyway, that's kind of motivation. How do these things actually work? So what's the input to this? Essentially, tell me what is changing and we'll make it happen, right? So in a class-based language, essentially you're interested in is tell me a set of classes that have changed in whatever way they've changed. Right? Okay, methods added, move as the hierarchy change, et cetera, and we'll make that happen. In NewSpeak, well, actually the unit of change is really mixins, and so it's really telling you what mixins have changed, and everything will follow from that. I'm not sure everybody knows what mixins are, so very quickly review those. So if you look at a class like this, this is, say, classical vanilla syntax. Class point 3D might be derived from a 2D point class. And this stuff in red, right, from here to here, that's the class body, right? That's essentially the part that the class is adding to the hierarchy. That's its contribution. That's whatever it is. It is different from the superclass, whatever it's adding or overriding, etc. And we'd like to reuse this thing so it isn't tied to a single inheritance hierarchy. And that's one way to look at the mixin. Another way to look at it is essentially imagine a function like this, that takes a superclass and gives you a class back. So the function, what the function returns is a new class. Right? So the body of this function from here to here is a class whose superclass is a parameter to the function. So you can reuse that class definition with everything that would be in it and produce multiple classes tied to different superclasses. So that's the notion of a mixin in case heard terms like traits, that's very closely related. Just in case not everyone is on the same page on this. Okay, now you get NewSpeak. In NewSpeak, you get mixins more or less for free because in NewSpeak, all names are late bound, including superclass names. So what that implies for you as a compiler writer is that you cannot do the standard thing of compiling this class into a static class hierarchy because at this point, you don't know what this does. Right, because that name of the superclass is essentially just another method call. And so you have to go through mixins from day one, so all the class declarations and mixins in NewSpeak essentially use mixins, just by way of background. So now we'll look at how this is actually, what takes place in the atomic install process, given a small world, but just big enough to be interesting, of various kinds of objects that will need modifications. So the circles are classes, the squares are mixins, and the stars are instances. So you've got a class C1 with a superclass C3, and then the hierarchy goes up somewhere to object, but I'm not showing that over here. Got another class C0, superclass C2, superclass C4, and then up into wherever it goes. Now, class in this situation is really, in essence, it is a mixin and a superclass. Those are the main ingredients here. Because basically, if you think of a mixin as a function, as I showed you, that gets applied to a superclass to produce a new class, that's really the two elements. So the essence of a class's representation is a pointer up to the superclass and a pointer to a mixin. And in this case, we've got so C4 has a mixin M4, C2 has a mixin M2, C3 has M3, and it's slightly more interesting about M1 because there are two classes that both share the same mixin, which is kind of a pointer mixin. Right? So there are two classes whose body, whose all their methods and fields come from a shared definition, but are tied to different class IDs. Everyone with me so far? And the stars are instances, so just for, it doesn't really matter how many instances there are for the logic, but some of these guys are instances. So this is the world we'll be working with to apply the change. So you start with a list of what's changed, right? A list of possibly new, there's also new stuff, right? New or the new stuff is relatively simple. You'll just create this mixin and it will be there, and you'll point to it from your ID. So we're really interested in what happens to existing stuff and how we manage the modification process. And potentially, each of these mixins has certain, may have one or more classes that are the result of essentially applying the mixin. Sort of applying the view of a function. And these classes might have subclasses, and all these classes and subclasses might have instances, and depending on the nature of the change, all of these guys may be influenced by that. Right? So if you add a field to a mixin definition, well, you're going to change the class, you're going to change the size of the class, that'll affect the size of the subclasses, and those will affect the actual layout of all the instances. So suppose we want to add M5, and we're going to now modify M1 and M2 to M1 prime and M2 prime. And we'll start with a simple case where we're not doing any schema changes. So none of these changes will involve actually adding or removing fields from these definitions. So who's going to be impacted here? At a minimum, obviously, M1 and M2. Everybody's impacted turns purple. And at least in our implementation, the classes are impacted. The classes that are applications of a mixin are impacted because there are things that have to be replicated for various reasons in the method table and things like that. You could imagine an implementation that might just be pure enough that you really didn't need to update the classes. But usually when you get into the business of how the constructors work and things like that, it's very easy, right? So we actually assume that the class hierarchy has to be replicated. So we've got these classes that are all instances of the mixins and nobody else changes. And since we didn't know how to do any schema changes, none of the instances are going to have to change. On the other hand, if we actually decide to change, say, the schema of M2, then we find that since M2 changed its shape, C2 changed its shape, instances of C2 changed their shape, and since C0 is a subclass of C2, also changed, so these have changed. But instances of C1 aren't impacted. And likewise, if we only change M1, well, we find that both C1 and C0 have changed their size, but C2 instances aren't new. So all these kinds of scenarios can happen depending on the logic. So how do we actually do this in broad strokes? Because in half an hour, they get very tedious to go blow by blow. It's about, all the process is about 400 lines of USB code. But essentially, we're going to accumulate a list of objects that get impacted, change, or will need to change. And we're going to go through all of them, produce new versions for them that reflect those changes, and then basically replace all the old objects with the new ones. So in this case, assuming this is a say the case where we changed M2 to add some fields or something. Right? So these are the originals we put in a list and say there isn't a vertical space, so there's just one star for all the instances. It doesn't matter. And these are the new guys. So we're going to have, we got these new instances as input, but we're going to produce new copies of classes for all of the new classes. And eventually we're going to go through all the instances of these classes and produce shaped instances, copying the data over and adding slots or removing slots. response as necessary. Right? Which brings up the interesting question. You can do it the way some of you guys have done it, right, by chasing down from some set group. But if you build it into your system, you can do it in several other ways. You can, in particular, you can just go through what we just literally find all instances. It's an unusual property of the various small class systems that there actually is an operation that will give you all the instances of a class, which is a really nice primitive to have, and things become rather painful in most systems when you don't have that. So the name of the key primitive that Smalltalk and its related systems give you is this thing called become, which basically in its original version would swap the identity of two objects. Right? We're not talking about swapping variables, we're swapping the identity of two objects. Everyone who refers to object B throughout the heap will now refer to object A and vice versa. Okay, so this is like a miracle, right? The laws of physics are suspended, and behind the scenes, the virtual machine goes and does this work. Now, this used to be really easy, because in the ancient Smalltalk implementations, there was an object table. All objects were referred to through handles, and so it was dead simple. That's how we came up with this. Nowadays, this thing is usually embedded with a garbage collector and goes through the heap does this whole thing. And there are several variants of this, but that's the basic thing, and that lets you take a list like this and process it. You don't have to do it that way. As heaps grow bigger, this is becoming more of an issue in terms of how long it might take you to do this. And so you can imagine there's various lazy schemes, some of which have been proposed in the literature, some of which, you know, you can pick a variant which I haven't seen in the literature, and they might be bigger in large systems with lots of memory. It might be better to do it that way. So in particular, the variant we use is a bulk one-way become. So we're not actually interested in the swap in this case. We just want to make, you know, we have a new object. We want everyone who pointed at the old object to now point at the new one. And we want to do this atomically for a whole bunch of them. So we take an array of existing objects. We have an array of what their new corresponding new versions are point-wise. You replace them all. And this is something that basically the virtual machine does for you. So you take this list and shazam, you're going to get this graph where, you know, all the impacted objects have been replaced. And the beauty of this is, you can see this in this case, right? So we said instances of C1 don't change because their layout hasn't changed, right? But they had a class pointer, right? And you haven't touched them, but they're now pointing at the right class after the change. These instances, for example, everybody who ever referred to them from wherever, whatever part of the application, now sees the new instance. It's completely transparent to the program. You don't care where in the program you were, what it was doing. You know, you've completely migrated the state automatically. And that's kind of nice, and that's basically how the newsfeed system works these days. There's a few other things that we like to design, a lot of other things we like to do. One thing is that, despite a simple thing, it's really a trivial change, so the UI for these things, in these kind of IDEs, is still built around individual operations that you can do. So you go ahead in a method, and you accept that method. You add a field, you do that, right? These systems that generally don't work with files or names, right? They actually are a structured view of the program. And you make individual changes. Now what happens is you're actually going to make a series of interdependent changes. You like to sort of make them, but not actually commit them. Right? You want a mechanism, and this is just a UI thing, because we already actually have almost all of it in place. It's based on files. Each individual method can be changed. It's a non-modal interface, so you can go run about the UI without worrying about losing that change. And all you need is the button to say, well, now I've got, you know, five different parts in place, now accept them all. So that's a small detail that actually is missing if you actually get that. What we don't, you know, these systems have not, I think, list people have done things, and you guys have done things where the question is, okay, beyond reshaping the objects, logically, what are they supposed to contain? Right? If you add a slot, what's going to be there, right? This is something that traditionally the systems have not coped with, right? The assumption is you can, given that you have all these reflective tools in your development environment, you can go do that later. You can ask for all instances of a class and write a little script that will do that. Nevertheless, it would be nice if the process integrated this more deeply, right? So that you actually have a part of the same story to atomically. You have to be very careful what that code is doing, of course, which is no doubt the case in your system as well, right? Because if it's side-effecting things, then you're not concrete. It knows what you might get. A much more interesting thing, which we did some experiments at one point, but it never got really mature enough to really do, was to enable the scenario of a software service where you sync both program and data. In particular, going over objects that have changed not just because of the program change, but objects that have changed just because, your collaborator has added stuff and you want to get all those changes into the heap of your running process and do that as a synchronization thing. So we actually had this implemented at one point, but it was dead slow, and it raises lots of interesting questions. It's very much like distributed source control. Once you start worrying about multiple people doing this. So that is a whole different talk, and still needs to be made real. And I don't know if we're ever going to have proceedings or any distributed things, but there's a whole bunch of links to various pieces of this. There's a whole bunch of people who contributed to this. And that's the essence of the story. And if there are any questions, I'll take them. Thank you.
Necessary to change the program at runtime using these kind of reflection-based methods?
Okay, so the primary scenario in practice is, of course, the development environment, where this is how we develop programs. Every program you can change is an in-place change to a running program. That's how the small dot culture has been working since 1956. So that's why there are primitives in the system that handle this, so you don't have to go through contortions. Because this is a system that was actually designed with this in mind, as opposed to trying to fit it into conventional structures like Java or anything else. Right? So you routinely do this. Right? Now, if you're asking about what would be real-life scenarios if you had an application for this, well, as the guy from Adobe said, any kind of bug fix, any kind of thing like this, the question is, do you want to stop everything and restart it? Maybe you've designed your application such that you can do that, right? What do web applications do? What happens with Google Docs? Every now and then, it gets stuck and tells you have to refresh. And if your docs are big enough, I shouldn't be saying bad things about Google Docs, because I happen to have a rather large Google Doc that I work with a lot of dark languages today. It would be nicer if it didn't go through that process, right? If it didn't, because it takes it a while to figure out where it is and to deal with a 100-page document and things like that, and you just like it to be instantaneous, right? And to take one example. And that's when the thing is sort of designed for that, right? The ideal is that the nice thing about this is you don't have to wire your application to know when it's being updated, right? The goal here actually for Newsweek was a platform where whatever program you wrote, it would naturally be able to function in such a service so that the client would work offline, be connected, synchronize and reconcile itself, and all of this without having to restart. And you wouldn't have to do a great deal of special work in your application. And yeah, I've given talks, if you're very bored, they're out of there somewhere. There's long talks about this thing. A lot of which is kind of, you can see with iCloud and stuff, a lot of this, parts of this are happening, right? But parts of it are not, because this is too blue sky and pure, but the basic idea of this update model and reducing the amount of harassment to people, right? So if you remember a few years ago when you updated your Mac, it would give you a legal contract that every single individual change that they had made to macOS came with its own individual form, and you had to click through and say, yes, I swear I won't sue Apple over this, right? And then they figured out, oh, we can have just one. And now in iOS, they finally figured that they should stop telling you that you have to update this thing. So it's becoming more transparent. Want to get it to the point where it's really, really nice and have a system support it so you don't have to go through so many things. Yeah?
In such a super flexible system, I guess it all the flexibility comes with some performance price tag, right? So I can see that it's really easy to get an interpreter, or like reasonable to get an interpreter for these kind of things. And you can do like a full GC over all your heap. But when programs get bigger, you might run into problems with full GC stuff and all the compiler things.
So there are several distinct points here which I'll address. So the first version of this Atomic install was actually built in a small system called StrongCock, which we did in the mid-90s. And there, the NewSpeak version, it's almost, except for Become, it's all NewSpeak code. It's basically user-level code, because the right version is there. But in StrongCock, this was both a more sophisticated VM. That's the smaller VM that was a precursor to Atomic Virtual Machine. Probably the fastest small dock that had been built.
Was that the one that Lars did?
Yeah, that's the one that Lars did. And one of the things Lars did was the primitive that took the list of mixins and went and shazammed everything and made everything, including de-optimizing all the methods and all that stuff. So it's harder, but it has been done and can be done. And you'll see it eventually in Dart, eventually. All my way through all of it. But we will get there, right? So where does this affect performance? Object-oriented languages, they reify the representation anyway. There has to be a class if you need dynamic dispatch. Beyond that, yes, they inline whatever, but you already have the optimization for all kinds of reasons, right? And once you get to that point, you need on-stack replacement. There's an enormous amount of very fancy machinery, but it's actually been largely done in pieces in different systems. And you can get, you're not going to get C performance, but you're going to get you could do it could even do it with Java if you completely revamped the version.
But then you have a huge runtime system that you then have to rely on top of it, and it becomes a burden to replace part of the runtime system.
So, you know, there's a whole trend of, you know, how much of a virtual machine can be written in the high-level language, and can you shrink the kernel, and then you apply your techniques to that in a much rarer case when you have to update that. But sure, fortunately, there's plenty of work to be done. Now, about the heap, right, there is this issue, which is why lazy become is interesting, right? So there's, for example, become and a primitive that lets you change the class pointer are actually interchangeable semantically. If you can do one, you can do the other. And if you, Squeak, actually, which we run NewSpeak on top of, happens to have both. But you can take an individual object and change its class. You better make sure that the class describes something of the same size, otherwise really nasty things might happen. But you can change it, right? And basically change all its behavior. So you can do that and become a, do that to the class of these objects. And at that point, the methods there, for example, could trigger. When you call them, they're going to rework the object. They'll keep a copy of the size of different names on the side table until the next GC, when you will already be processing this. You know, there's no end of cleverness that can be applied. It doesn't have to be a monolithic suite. So there's interesting things that can be done there.
Thanks.